Welcome, dear listeners. This is episode 121 of the Devon Dice podcast. In this podcast, we are going to be doing a topic tapas. Trademarked, registered and copyrighted. All thanks to Nick, apparently.
Yum, 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 yum.
I'm Joel, the host of the podcast, and joining me today is Sam.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello, I'm back again.
It must be my internet that's really delayed. Anyway, right. So, welcome everyone. we're doing our podcast tonight is a topic tapas because couldn't think of one long-winded topic to talk about. So we're going to do a few little ones and cover a few bases to fill in a podcast because I couldn't think of anything earlier. Anyway, we're going to start it off. So, if you've not listened to the Devon Board Game Weekender podcast, which I put out a couple a week or so ago, we were basically going through our weekend at the Fox and Hound Hotel. And at the bottom of the script, I was actually trying to do a comparison of all the gaming events that are in the Southwest mainly, and what they bring to each event. So we're going to look at those now and see if this works. And I don't know if it is. So we've got listed, and I don't know if Nick will be able to add any more, or Sam. We've got the Fox and Hound Devon Weekender, the Torbay Weekender, which is the full board gaming weekend, the 24-hour board gaming marathon, GridCon, and BayCon.
And Devon DiceCon.
When we finally set it up.
Will that be in Devon is the question.
It'd be quite funny if we don't have it in Devon.
Yes. In Cornwall or something.
It'll be at UK Games Expo on the Sunday, probably.
Well, BayCon is not in BayCon anymore, because that was in the Torbay area. It's now in Exeter.
Yeah, yeah.
GridCon stands for Gaming Rules in Devon convention, which is now in Somerset.
And it's not in Devon, it's in Somerset, isn't it? Yeah. So only three of them are actually in Devon. Well, you did say Southwest, so that's fair.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to cover. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, not a great first topic to start with. It mainly consisted of me talking a lot of the time because I'm the only one that's really gone to them all. So, we are going to skip over this and maybe review all the conventions in the Southwest in a later podcast later in the year when people have been to more of them. So, we're going to proceed to topic number two, and it's going to get better from here, I promise. No,
more tapas. Next round.
Number two. Sorry, phone. Oh, I've done all my rings on my watch. Number two. Disappointment.
Making your own script again.
Yeah, disappointment in components. So this is just something that I realise actually bothers me now. I've just received a copy of Axe.
What's it called?
Axon Protocol.
And components are great. The box is great. Everything I expected is great. Except for the fact is, I feel like I'm being done a little bit because they've incorporated components for German and English. So I've got two decks of cards, one in English and one in German.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two sets of those. So
you
I feel
have to pay
like
for effectively both of them.
Yeah, and I felt like when I opened it, I was like, "Oh, so there's quite a lot of components in there. That's all right, lots of decks." And then I started realizing actually, one of these is German, and is useless.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, I'm a little disappointed now." And then I'm thinking, "Hold on a minute."
There are some games that do that where they have that they'll. Just to make it simpler for them for printing, They'll just do all the languages, and you'll have multiple decks with different languages for each deck. Much like you get multiple rule books sometimes. But I haven't seen it very often.
I don't mind rule books. That's fine. It's like Among Cultists came with every language possible in rule books in the box. But the components in that are all language independent, so that doesn't bother me. It's just when you can get like a deck of cards, because it's in different text in a different language, it's just like, well, I've paid shipping on that, and I've now got two decks of useless cards to me, unless I want to make it really hardcore mode and play with the German side and try and figure out what it's trying to tell me.
Yes. Add that in as a mechanic.
It could be quite educational, teaching yourself German while playing the game. That's pretty much what they used to do in the old days, didn't they? When the game was only printed in German, so someone had to like kind of try and translate it.
Yeah. Yes, and before Google Translate as well, so you had literally word for word, word by word.
Yeah, or you had a German.
Yeah, I don't know how else they would do this. I don't know how they would do it without. Obviously, you'd have to have separate printings for the different languages. And if you're a certain size of company, it probably doesn't make sense to have to print 1,001 language, 1,001 language, because I don't know if you would get the volume discount by doing that. Whereas if you print all 5,000 in one go, you get the discount. So I don't know if you were ripped off necessarily. You'd probably find that you have actually saved money in the long run, because otherwise they would have had to charge more per unit to separate them out. But it doesn't mean you'll end up with useless cards, which is frustrating when you have like a whole deck of cards that you can't. So the one game I remember that's done this, which is actually just a small box game, is Oh My Goods expansion.
Oh, yeah.
Which came with half the deck is German, half the deck is English. And there were some other cards that were language independent, but yeah, you end up with almost half the box is just German cards you can't use if you don't read German. And that always annoyed me, especially with a small box like Oh My Goods. It's you don't want to have half the box wasted with cards you won't use. And then do you throw them out, or do you keep them in case you sell the game on? Otherwise you're just keeping cards around for no reason.
I mean, with rule books that are different languages, I either put them at the bottom of the insert, or I've kept them stored away elsewhere. But then I usually forget I've got them stored away elsewhere, and then I've sold the game and then find them later on. But I feel like it's just a disappointment. It's like once I realise actually only half of these components are good enough for what I need. And all the effort they've gone into...
Only half the ones you're going to use,
yeah. Yeah, all the effort they've gone into, like, having both sets. Because even the board is double-sided. So it's got German on one side and English on the other.
And that's fine, because that's just one component that you just flip over. That's easy enough.
Yeah.
But I'd say that it does come back to what you just said, Nick, that it would have been a cheaper way to be able to have a print run that they could afford. Otherwise, they'd have had to have had two print runs for two separate languages or something, and it would have been way more expensive for everybody to sort of have language-specific versions. So I can understand why they do that. Me, personally, I would just recycle the stuff I don't need, quite frankly, because I'm very unlikely to be able to trade it or sell it to someone who only wants the German version.
Well...
Although, to be honest, I would keep it, because obviously you keep it because it's completest, but if it was one I was keeping, I would just sling them.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Once I have a play of it, then I'll decide how good enough it is. the price I've got here I paid for it is £56 plus shipping. Oh, no, that included shipping. So...
Oh, there you go. Bargain. Bargain that not quite... twice the price.
I don't know if it's comparable to like Box Air. So when the people made a fuss about how much a game took up inside a box, didn't it? And it was just like, well, the rest of it's air. I think that doesn't bother me. It is just the fact that now I've got a couple decks of useless cards. That's really bothered me about it. But maybe that's just me. Let us know in the comments if you feel the same way. Or am I just being stupid? I don't mind. number three on the agenda is one of the Lewis Holt questions. So we're going back to these.
He's back. Yeah, we still got Lewis Holt.
Yeah, he's back. We've still got a few questions.
Still got a load. His question around the walls, impressive.
He is single and not much else to do, but so he's got plenty of time on his hands.
Slightly harsh.
We say worse things about each other on our little chat, so that's nothing. Do you agree, or am I just getting old? Is there a fear of the gaming market becoming saturated with reskins of games if they don't evolve? Which is a great question, I think, for Nick to answer, because he's a board game designer.
I would agree. I would agree that it is already getting almost to that point where we get so many games. I mean, a lot of games now, we're getting re-releases of... they're doing like these special editions of things like Puerto Rico and Castle Burgundy, where they take a decent game and in some cases some very popular games, and they will just do a refresh, like an art refresh, the new artwork. So they did that with things like Bonanza, and as we've mentioned earlier, Glory to Rome. They did nicer versions, and those are fine. The people enjoy those, make nicer copies. But then you do get the games where they will just completely reskin it, and it's basically the same game, but they're trying to pass off as something new. It does feel like there is a lack of innovation in the market at the moment, of truly innovative games coming out that have new things. I think the most recent innovative mechanic was Legacy stuff, and that was, what, 7, 8 or more years ago with Risk Legacy?
Yeah.
I don't think anything truly innovative has come out since then that I can remember. No. What do you think, Sam?
I think that's just a symptom of them. I mean, it's difficult to say, oh, it works because everything's been invented, everything's been created. There's no room now for innovation. I don't think that's true. There'll always be some way of innovating, but it's always going to be taking what's been done before and layering it, as opposed to necessarily coming up. I think in terms of game mechanics, we're largely done. Otherwise, yes. I think we would have seen something remarkable.
We haven't seen many new mechanics. We have seen blending of mechanics together in new ways, which is interesting.
Yeah, so exactly. So I think like the worker placement deck building stuff and that sort of stuff was a couple of years ago. It was like, oh, that's a bit more interesting because it's taking two things and putting them into a game and stuff, and I think we'll see more and more of that kind of stuff. Not to say that won't be another mechanic, but
and I think a symptom of Kickstarter is that you get things like the Zombicide, where they just put an IP over the top of it, and there's no real innovation or new stuff in there at all. It's great if you enjoy the IP and you haven't played the original, but
it's kind of analogous to movie production, I think, in the sense that the big publishers now are largely kind of they're treading out the same stuff they know is popular that will sell because it
let's do another Mission Impossible type thing.
Yeah, whereas and I think to some degree it always used to be that on Kickstarter it was like people would try things on Kickstarter because it's people that come up with a novel idea.
Yeah.
And I think we'll still see that to some degree, and there will be publishers that just do testing things, and we'll always see it. But I think it's probably to some degree always been the case that it'll be it's just more amplified now because we're able to discover it a lot more easily than we would have done.
And there's just so many more games that
you're
bound to get some which are just reskins.
Yeah, I think there was a question a few years ago. We were always questioning, is this peak board game? You know, it's like 2018. It's been an amazing year. Is it can this keep going? And I think we're starting to get to a point where we're realizing it can't easily keep going at that pace. It will still keep going. There'll always be new games, and people will always want new stuff. Talking about Fox Experiment in the last one, for instance, I genuinely think that is quite... there's interesting designs and interesting themes.
That's true. There is innovation in themes and settings. Yeah.
And I think that's where stuff's going to happen a little bit. Yeah. Like we had the Molly House and those kind of stuff, where it's taking culturally or historically interesting themes and making games out of them that's quite innovative and interesting now, as opposed to it necessarily being mechanical.
And yeah, they are still coming out with train games.
Yeah, exactly. Again, but they sell, don't you? I think.
But they sell because people enjoy
them.
Yeah.
I'm not overly concerned about the future of board games. I think we'll always have them, and it's kind of there'll always be people publishing them. But I do think it's reached critical mass to some degree in terms of the we're seeing places shut up shop or Asmodee buy them, but then and they end up kind of sidelining studios because there's just not enough, they're not making enough money or anymore and stuff. And I think a few years ago it was more of a passion project to publish board games, and it would have been like a, it didn't have to be commercially.
Yeah, there were a lot more small companies, indie companies that just did one or two games, and that was it. That was what they wanted to do.
And I think it'll end up kind of collapsing back to something not dissimilar. Mm. There'll be the big players like the Simons and stuff that do keep trotting out the same stuff, but there's a certain point where I think even the people that buy everything from certain publishers are going to get to a point of, I've had enough. I can't keep doing it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're too far away from, 4 or 5 years, and we'll start seeing it.
Collapse.
It'll start kind of ticking down again, and we'll see. I don't know. But I'm not too worried about the future of it, and I'm not too concerned about the like the reskins kind of element of it, because I think as long as it's not like this was like the Castle Burgundy one, for instance, they go, right, this is the heirloom edition, amazing game. In 3 or 4 years, if they do it again, then that's jumping the shark. But I think if they're taking older games that were ugly as sin, quite frankly, and giving them a new lease of life, it actually helps to kind of get people to try those games. Like Brass, I would never have played Brass at all if it was the original artwork. They reskinned it, and I'm just like, oh, that looks amazing. I'd give that a try now. Castle Burgundy was almost exactly the same. I didn't touch it because from a colourblind perspective, it was a nightmare. The new one, really nice, easy to play. So I think there are good reskins and good reasons to reskin. But yeah, obviously if the market just ends up being just reskins of stuff that's already out there, then it's dead, isn't it? I mean, if there's no new stuff coming, then it's a dead industry, really.
It's the same, I think, could be said for the video game market, is that they've done pretty much everything, and so they are just trying to build on what they've already got, or reskins keep coming out of a game that's already been done, or rehashing old games. And I think this is the same thing. It's like, unless someone comes up with something really creative of an innovative new mechanic it's not been thought of, it seems like it's done. People just need to keep building on it.
I think it's... I think that's fine, though. I think iterative development is fine. It doesn't have to be innovative for it to be interesting or fun or worth buying or anything. I think as long as the iterations are compelling enough to try and play, then I think that's no problem for me. Good example of that, again, is Brass Birmingham, where essentially it's Brass, but with a little bit of an iteration to the rules.
Yeah.
And it's now the most popular game on BGG, so I think that there's value to iterative design as well.
Yeah.
As long as people keep coming up with new ideas, whether it be a thematic thing or a component thing or mechanical, then I think we'll all be happy, won't we?
Oh, definitely. Indeed. I
suppose the other part of it is also production as well, because like video games is a good example where. And movies, back to the other ones, is special effects in movies, or whether it be the graphical quality that you can get out of your code for the game. That's where the sort of iterative development starts to help, because you can start doing things in different ways that you wouldn't have considered with the technology you had at the time. And I think that to a certain degree that's less important for board games, but to a certain way there is. If we're seeing like app development or web apps and stuff that are being used for board games, that's going to have a kind of that'll be a lasting kind of trend in order to drive a bit more innovation in the future.
Yeah.
And also sort of like the ability for publishers to access better production quality, whether it be in wood or plastic or Kutna Hora that used the kind of wood pulp kind of new recycling stuff?
Wood.
You know, That's another interesting kind of take, isn't it? On again, that's the new innovation, is in terms of, okay, it's the game is still fun and different, and whatever. But actually, the way it's been made is kind of an interesting thing in itself. So there'll be lots of that sort of stuff, I think.
That would be really interesting, actually, to see a classical game like Puerto Rico, for example, being redone with material like that. So you could have you could have a silk screen cloth mat instead of a board. You could have rewood as the wooden components and things. Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting to see what they could do.
But they won't, because kind of it's not, they can't, because their focus is on quality.
Yeah,
they
won't do. I don't.
There?
Not for that. But if you find maybe an out of print game which was popular and they want to bring back, and they may say, well, we can produce it this way, and it's going to be half the price of the you would usually pay for a game, and it's going to be environmentally friendly and all of that. I think there's a lot they could do with that.
In your terms, you mainly work on solo modes for games that are already done, or like you said, you helped with the solo mode on Castles of Burgundy with your mate. Do you have to find a new way of like doing a solo mode for each game you work on? Because you can't really just take one from another game. So,
they will all share very similar similar DNA, I would say. But every solo mode will have to have some kind of different twist to make it work in that game. So if you think things like Teotihuacan has the little pyramid of solo tiles, which kind of link thematically in where you'll move the tiles around. Snowdonia has rail tracks for the solo where the cubes move along and trigger the action placement. So you always want to find a little twist to go with a certain game, but mechanically what you're doing is you're just trying to replicate the interactions with the other player. And sometimes you may not have an AI. Maybe you're just going for, you're designing challenges for the player to beat. So there's always something different. And it's not necessarily always the same way to implement it in every game.
Do you find there's a pressure that you need to make it different from the other ones, or so people don't say, oh, it's just the same as...
Not particularly.
So-and-so game.
Because they are... You're tuning it very much to the game, and you're just applying a certain system or systems to the game to see if they'll work. If they don't, you'll try a different way. But they, even if they're, it's like saying, is one worker placement game, do you have to do the same kind of worker placement in another game because you call it worker placement? No, you want to do similar so people know what they're expected to do, but you can change it to be, like in, is it Shipwrights and also where you place and then you can take off as well to reactivate the spot. You can innovate a bit on that kind of mechanic. Right. So yeah, there isn't really pressure to do the same thing, but they will share a lot of the DNA between each other because they're designed by the same group of people all the time. You find that with Automa Factory as well, with their modes, that they are similar in their approach to how they design it.
Okay. I mean, this does lead on to, like, you actually covered a little bit of it, and seeing we've got time. One of Lewis's other questions was, do you think games are leading towards being saturated with algorithms of others amalgamations of others blending mechanics to create unnecessary complex games? Now, instantly...
yes and no. That's the answer to that.
I think of Art Nova, because that's like the thing, this is a blend of like multiple games into one, but it's actually not complex. I think it's quite clever and subtle. I don't know what game he's...
It's kind of like dog breeds. It's kind of like crossbreeding, essentially, in a way. It's like...
Like Fox Experiment.
like a cocker... it's kind of like cockapoos, right? So it's like everyone loves a cockapoo. So cocker spaniel, poodle, perfectly nice dogs, blend it, it's become a really nice dog. I mean, it's the same sort of deal in a way, where there's no harm, I think, in amalgamating. Like we talked about it in terms of the, it's another way of innovating in a way of, because that's kind of what's left as a, it's an easier thing to do to innovate on a design to blend two mechanics that haven't been blended either before or very much. And I think that's, it's I'd say it's a valid way to do it, but again, it's another way of saying, well, if everyone's doing that, then eventually there's nothing new under the sun, and we'll end up with just the same things treaded out with different themes. And but I think we're always going to end up with that. There'll always be out of you know, there'll be 20% of games are going to be new and interesting and different, and 80% are going to be amalgamations of stuff that's come before, but in slightly different formats or slightly different themes.
And sometimes that change will actually make the game better than the original.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing that. But there are examples where you combine so much, you put so much in, it does become unnecessarily overly complex. Just adding things for the sake of making it heavy game. We go, oh, I'm going to make this really, really complicated heavy game, and you just bung everything in, including the kitchen sink, and it just becomes unwieldy, and no one can understand what's going on, and it's impossible to balance, and it takes 4 hours to play, and things like that. I think some games are going that way, where in order they think they're innovating, and what they're actually doing is just throwing everything in.
Yeah, and it's not just like complicated games or people that set out to make a complicated game. I think it's the same's true for games that should be simpler or have aimed to be simpler have become complicated or bloated. You know, we talked about Tidal Blades in the previous episode, and that's one I think became bloated and convoluted because they tried to do a bit too much. They didn't sort of pare it back and thin it down.
And that's where I think you want to take out enough stuff where you could add that in an expansion. So you start with a base game that is as streamlined as you can be, and then you can give players the possibility of adding in expansion content, which adds complexity.
Which is why, I hate that thing with Kickstarters right now, where they give you like a dozen expansions.
Where they go, well, we bung all of them in at once, and you go,
we don't even know if we like the game yet. We don't even know what we want in a new in an expansion, but you're giving us all these expansions already. And it's just, I just find it madness that you're going to play. I mean, how many expansions do I actually use? Very few. I don't want like a whole bunch to come with a game. I just want a good game, and if it's good enough, I'll want to expand it, maybe.
I
think
expansions before were just either brought out to improve the core box because they might need to errata stuff that they discovered once it was released, or expand on the game. Bring
just
the game back
variety.
Into bring the game back into the public eye again. To say, this game's still around. We've now got an expansion. It adds this little element to it. Now you can do, or this is what the fans have been asking for. So we're adding it as expansion. But now it just seems
you'd have years between that, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah,
you'd have years between between a base game release and an expansion release.
But now you're
now
seeing
it's like 10 minutes, or it's like the game releases and you've already got a flyer in the box about the expansion that's coming out in 6 months. Yeah. time. it's just like,
and that's kind of the industry is driving that, I think, or it's the consumers are probably driving that as well. Where publishers now feel obliged to, if they think the game is going to work, they will be starting on the expansion design before the base game has been released. A lot of time, and that I've done that with games I've worked on, where we've finished the design of the base game, and we've handed it over to the publisher. They'll start doing their work on it, and then they will say, "Well, can you get something in the pipeline ready for if we need expansion?" And so we'll start working expansion before the base game's even gone to Kickstarter. And it may never be used, but if it's popular enough, then it can. That we'll say 6 months later, we'll say, "Right, well, it's ready." We'll be able to do a reprint of the base game, knowing how popular it is and how many people wanted it. It keeps them, especially because these days the release of a game is if it doesn't do well, that's it. It's gone. You'd never hear of it again. And you need to keep that in the public's mind that the game still exists. And so, that time between base game and expansion releases has come massively down. And it does feel like it's just come straight off the back. There's no time in between.
Yeah, though I think at the moment the base games now just don't get the time to earn their following half the time.
They don't have the time. They have to make a splash, otherwise the publisher can't. They won't be able to reprint it because they won't
Yeah, and again, it goes back to the kind of movie thing, doesn't it? If the box office isn't big enough, then they won't bother greenlighting the sequel.
Yes.
Kind of stuff.
Yep. Exactly.
I think we diverse quite far from that, from the original question. But anyway, it's fine.
I think Lewis's questions were designed as starting points for discussions.
Yeah,
definitely
answering exact questions.
And they're actually
so yeah, good questions, Lewis.
Yeah, and there's still a few more to come. We've still got a couple more to come from him. So
yeah,
we're holding back for another time. So we're going to finish off the show with some non-board gaming stuff to talk about. More or less what TV shows we've been watching, books we've been reading, and any Marvel content I've been indulging myself in, or not. I've not actually, but anyway.
As always.
Yep. So Nick, do you want to start us off with this? I've seen this advertised. It does have me intrigued. So.
Yeah. So this is The Artful Dodger, which is on Disney Plus at the moment. It is an 8-episode series. I don't know if they'll be making another one. They left it in a way that they could well have a second series if they wanted. It is really good. I really, really enjoyed it. I kind of binge-watched it because I was totally addicted to the story. But this is the story of what happens to the characters from Oliver Twist about 15 years after the events of Oliver Twist. So this is The Artful Dodger. He's in Australia. He worked as a ship's surgeon and is now... in Australia working as a surgeon, and the Fagin, his old pickpocket friend from London, turns up and starts trying to integrate himself into Dodger's life again, and it's all about their relationship and what's happening. There's this kind of there's a scheme that you know is going on that Fagin's trying to work on. And you don't really know what it is, and it somehow is trying to involve the Dodger. And he is also trying to help this young lady who he's met, who is very strongly wanting to become a surgeon herself. And obviously it's set in a time where women were not surgeons. They were nurses, if anything. And she is very high up in society, and so it's not her place to do that kind of thing. And so he's trying to help her to kind of learn how to be a surgeon, and she's very, very well educated, and she's read all of the stuff about these the operations. She's trying to push new discoveries to get them to try them out. It's really fascinating how it develops. There's a really interesting twist about halfway through, or two-thirds of the way through, and it's a very, very well produced show. And it's great. Yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Check it out.
Yeah, that sound cool. And that kind of goes back to that last question that we sort of. With Lewis is it's iterative, right? You know, it's like the innovation is now in terms of new stories. It's kind of taking an existing property and finding a new way of working with it. And I think it's quite fun, the new TV streaming options, you know, all the publishers that all the studios and stuff now, and the money that's available for TV production is creating some really interesting.
It is amazing. The production quality is just amazing. How they've done some of this. I didn't say it's the main guy who plays Dodger is the guy. He was the small boy in Love Actually, and he was one of the small boys in the Maze Runner films, and he's now like 28 or something. So yeah, he's the main guy. He does really, really well. Fagin's played by David Thewlis, who people might know as he was in. Oh, my brain's gone today.
But Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
The werewolf guy.
Yes. Lupin.
That's it.
And he is brilliant as Fagin.
I know him best from The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yes. Brilliant stuff. And he is excellent as Fagin. He plays him very, very well. He's kind of ideally cast as that, I think. It's really good.
Yeah, I'll add that to my list, I think.
Yeah, good fun to watch. Also, and the lady who's the girl in that as the main character, she hasn't been in a lot. The one I know her from is Teen Beach Movie, because my kids watch it all the time, which is a atrociously cheesy Disney film. But yeah, she is also very, very good. She acts it very well.
Oh, yeah, I think Megan will like that one as well. So I think I'll add that to our shared kind of
Indeed.
Weekend TV viewing. Also on Disney Plus is Shogun now, which is getting rave reviews. I've only watched the first episode, but I decided I wanted to read the book before the TV show came out, which I think in hindsight was maybe a mistake because now I can see all the gaps and things they've changed. But the book is absolutely fantastic, really, considering it was written in 1975. It's wonderful. Really, really good, rip-roaring tale. For those that don't know, Shogun is a tale of the first Englishman to land on the shores of Japan, and everything that sort of unfolds from there. How he integrates into the society while similarly trying to find a way home for most of it. I'm not going to say any more about it because there's an awful lot that could be spoiled. But it's wonderful. I'm a Japanophile anyway, as you kind of know. And this is like the perfect book and the perfect TV show for me. It's all based in sort of feudal Japan around the age of the Civil War of the 17th century, early, right at the start of the 17th century, so 1600 onwards. It's all made up characters because it's not really the real Civil War, but it's kind of based very much around it all. So the start of the Tokugawa shogunate and stuff. So if you know any of your Japanese history, it's very relatable. But if not, then you're just going to see loads of cool stuff like samurais and seppuku and whatnot. So what's not to like? But it's pretty brutal, but fascinating. Yeah, really good. So I can't wait to see more of that.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Yesterday at midday, I went to watch Dune Part 2. Fantastic. I can't wait to go watch it again. I'm definitely going to go and watch it again. Probably in IMAX this time instead of just the picture house in Exeter. I want to go and get it like full size, full volume, the whole shebang.
The one thing I saw that was, if you go and see it at the cinema, see it in the largest screen you possibly can.
Yeah. Well, I did that with Part 1. I was busting for a wee for 3 hours because I refused to leave my seat. Yeah, I didn't want to miss any of it. So I ended up crossing and uncrossing my leg for every 10 seconds. It was horrible. But also, I think we sat too close to we were about halfway back in the Cineworld in Plymouth. Yeah. And it was just too close still because it was so big.
Wow.
I was like looking from one side of the screen to the other to be able to take in the whole frame. So I want to sit a bit further back next time.
Too big.
I want to get the better volume because the sound in Picture House is fine, but it's not terrific. And I think the sound is so good in Dune Part 1, and I'm sure it was in Dune Part 2 as well.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it in full scale.
That's
really.
So cool.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Does it end the story, or is there going to be a part 3? Can you not say?
Denis Villeneuve, he is writing the third. He's writing a film based on Dune Messiah, which is the second.
Okay.
So it does end with a clear lead in to it if it's allowed. He's written it, I think. I think he's pretty much said he's finished writing. So it's ready to go if Warner Brothers green light it. From the look of things, I suspect they will, because critically. Audience-wise, it's getting rave reviews. And it's the first box office, I think it's the first weekend, and it's done nearly $200 million worldwide. So I'm pretty sure they're going to greenlight it. And I hope they do. I think it would be it'd be the first time we've seen something new in Dune since the Sci-Fi Channel stuff. As a two-parter, even if they don't, as a two-parter, it's just wonderful. Yeah, absolutely loved it. Yeah, amazing.
Brilliant.
And my final bit that I was going to just mention, because I've finished Shogun, now I've now moved back to my familiar hunting ground of science fiction. And I am reading the sixth book of eight in the Murderbot series by Martha Wells. And that's notable purely because Apple TV have commissioned TV series based on it. And Murderbot's really fun. They're quite short books. They're only 100-150 pages long. But it's a really fun theme of like a security robot, essentially, like a android, really, who's got like metal bits and human bits. And he manages to hack himself so that he no longer has to obey the control module that's in his head, so he doesn't have to follow the orders if he doesn't want to, kind of thing. But all he really wants to do is like isolate himself and watch TV shows and soap operas and stuff. He doesn't really want to have to deal with people or speak to people, or, you know, very relatable to most of us.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's because he's a security robot, he's kind of contracted by his company to kind of go and provide security in, like, on other planets where science teams are doing research and stuff, and he has to sort of protect them from the native fauna or from pirates or whatever. And it's all the sort of stuff that ensues from that, and it's really fun. It's kind of from a very, it's slightly whimsical. The Murderbot character himself is that's what he calls himself, Murderbot. He is quite a funny character in a way, because it's just written in that kind of slightly off the, trying to think of the right words for it, but it's whimsical, I guess, is the only way to sort of put it. It's kind of serious. It's serious science fiction, but it's done in a very clever, offbeat kind of way. I highly recommend it. It's quite a short read, but the TV show I'm expecting to be pretty fantastic. I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool.
Yeah, the first book's actually free to listen to on Audible. All systems read.
Perfect. There you go.
Yeah.
So yeah,
and it's discounted on Kindle as well.
Highly recommended.
I'll read.
Yeah.
Cool. Just added that to my library, along with leads nicely onto. I am listening to one of Sam's recommendations in books, and that is The Venomous Bloodsucker. But Bob, no, was it Venomous?
Oh, really? Awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
Venomous Lumpsucker.
Lumpsucker, that's it, not Bloodsucker.
A Lumpsucker, that's it, yeah.
It is awesome. I'm only just started it, and I'm already, like, hooked on it. I was like, oh, I can't miss a word of this kind of thing. So yeah.
It's good, isn't it? After you get into the way it's written, it's kind of, it's very funny.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, and the narrator's actually pretty good. A bit dubious about some of his female voices he's trying to put on, but because they all sound the same, but yeah, it's all right. I can get through that. It's just like, yeah, now I'm getting into a little bit more where he's actually gone to visit the scientists on the boat, Sam. So that's as far as
cool. So it's quite early on.
Yeah. It is quite early, but I'm already enjoying it. I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be good. Yeah.
Especially, the corporate guy trying to dig himself out of a giant hole he's made for himself. It's just funny.
And it's very clever the way that she's created this kind of, like, the credit system for, like, companies to spend credits on if they're going to endanger a species and wipe it off and things like that.
Yeah. It's strangely prescient. It's kind of like, this could be something that the corporate world end up doing at some point, and it's really horrible and scary, it's scarily possible. That's the trouble.
so yeah, looking forward to finishing that, and then I'll probably get onto Murderbot. I've been going through a bit of a film catch up. Like I said, at the end of last year, there's quite a lot of films I've not watched and really need to catch up on, so I had a bit of a blitz on it. So I watched that Rebel Moon. It was all right. I don't know if you two have watched it.
It's all right.
I haven't finished it. I didn't get far. I got halfway through and went, it's all
right. I'm glad it was a streamer and not a sit in the suit cinema job.
Yeah, that's about as good as it is.
I could see what it was doing as it was, kind of, it was intended as a Star Wars story. Mm. If it had been a Star Wars story, I think it would have been really good.
Mm.
But take that away and it's just kind of okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely
lose something like
that. It feels derivative now because it wasn't a Star Wars film, basically, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and it had that thing of it would have been fun if he'd done a bit more careful. I like the idea of the Seven Samurai in space kind of thing. That's cool, but it felt very derivative of that.
Mm.
Indeed,
Morbius, the kind of vampire spin-off character from Spider-Man, that was also
classic.
Good, but not good. As I think it was, I think it rushed its story, and wasn't much.
And unfortunately, has Jared Leto in the lead part, which is never a good thing.
I know. So it's a shame, and it was meant to be some kind of spin out from there's a bit of an end trailer bit, and they're making the Sinister Six, but I don't even know if that's going to happen now because they keep screwing up their offshoots of Spider-Man. Have you seen the
reboot? Well, the next one is going to be the next one's going to be what's the hunter guy called?
Oh, Kraven.
Kraven the Hunter, that looks pretty terrible.
Oh, but have you seen all the reviews for Madame Web?
They didn't go down well. My daughter's seen that. She said it was right.
Yeah,
she quite enjoyed it. But
so bad, it's good. You need to watch it.
It was a bit silly.
So bad.
Yes,
just to experience it. So, Ghostbusters, the new revamped kind of actually comes from the originals. Awesome, loved every minute of that.
Was this Afterlife?
Afterlife, that's
it. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Oh, just so great. Yeah, so looking
really enjoyed it.
One.
Yeah, it's both a love letter to Ghostbusters and also just a wonderful new tale. I can't wait for Frozen Empire.
Definitely.
Mm.
And I just love how all the cameos coming into it and
how they.
I thought it was how they handled Egon in it. I thought it was really.
Oh, nice. That was beautiful.
Someone was cutting onions in the kitchen, I believe, and that's why my eyes were watering. that's all I'm going to say on that. So yeah, Ghostbusters, brilliant. Uncharted, fun. I enjoyed it because it was fun.
Oh,
and
I watched
silly.
It was silly fun. Yeah. That was.
And Tom Holland is a great actor. I think he's brilliant.
He is.
And he had a good chemistry with Mark Wahlberg, even though I can't stand Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
It kind of worked.
Can you not? Oh, so, I don't mind it.
But it was just a fun romp. It was quite close to the video game and done some good things. So I thought it was great for what it was. And then also, again, because of Sam, blame Sam for this.
Oh, Sam.
He got me...
Too many good ideas.
He got me onto the Silo books. So I've listened to all three Silo books. Mm-hmm. And now we've started watching the TV series. And, oh my God, the TV series is great. But it does... There's like lots of things that are not in the book that they've put into the TV series. And Claire's like, what's going on? I said, I actually have no idea. This is all new to me kind of thing. So, and just before we started reading, she wanted to watch
it. It's largely the broad strokes are the same.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can see where it's going to go to and what's going to happen. But there's just bits I think they've done for TV purposing. Which makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It really does.
I think it's short-cutting. Yeah, I think it's a short-cutting a little bit. Yeah. Which is fair enough, because I think if they tried to do it the same way the book did it, it's kind of awkward. You have to do a little bit of time jump and stuff to make it work. And I can understand why they've done it the way they have.
And there was a bit... So the bit that me and Claire literally sat down and watched an episode before we started recording tonight. And I was just saying to Sam where we got to. And then I was just like, oh, they've already introduced that. Which I was like, okay, because they don't introduce that part until the second book. And I was just like, okay, I can deal with this. I was expecting it a bit later on and that, but like Claire sat going, what's going on? Is it like Truman Show? Is it an experiment? Is it this? And I was like, can't tell you. I'm not going to tell you. So, it's great watching her reaction to it, and I'm sat there going, I don't have a clue what's going on now. I mean, Apple TV, looking at all the stuff that's coming on it, I'm just like, I might just...
If I had to pick one of them, Netflix, Amazon, all of it, I'd keep Apple over all of them.
Do you know what? I'm thinking the same.
They're generating stuff that's best.
Yeah, I might just drop Netflix at this point, because I don't find myself watching a lot of it. And I really screw up the daughter because she just watches Friends on the loop and it's really bothering me.
Mm.
So I might just drop.
Disney's the one that's going to go for me.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. If it hadn't auto-renewed last month without me realising it for another year, I would have been cancelling it. But thankfully, I've got Shogun to watch and now I've got Artful Dodger, so I can watch them before I cancel it now.
And their prescription's getting more and more expensive each year, isn't it? It's like nearly...
All of them are, though, aren't they? All of them.
They're all going up.
Disney Plus has risen quite a lot.
I still think Apple, still think Apple represents the best value currently for me. I think the stuff that they've got there is like Slow Horses. Have you guys watched Slow Horses yet?
I don't have Apple TV, so I'm missing all of this.
When you finish Silo, Slow Horses is next. Trust me, you don't need to. Have you watched For All Mankind yet?
No, not yet. Silo is the only thing I've watched.
Oh my god, you've got so much stuff.
I know.
So you've got Slow Horses and For All Mankind.
I know. I'm trying.
Turn Ted Lasso. Have you watched Ted Lasso?
No, Silo is the only thing I've watched.
Oh my god. Right. So you're not right. Yeah, cancel everything else. Keep Apple and just work your way through that, and that'll be fine.
Thing is, it's my time's taken up with karate, editing podcasts, and any other shit that comes my way. I'll fill in application forms for jobs. So that's my week. So it's like, oh, I've got a spare hour. I might sit down and watch a TV show now. So, yeah. So that's it. That's what I've been doing.
We need a new channel, by the way, on the Discord server for TV chat, I think.
I do.
Yeah. Oh, he's yes. Done.
Done.
I'll work out to do it. Love it.
Okay, so that wraps up another show, I believe. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please send us your comments. Just tell us what you've been watching, what you liked, what you thought about our topic tapas episode, and whether you want to hear more, or was it that bad that we should give it up now?
You've already tuned out.
You've already tuned out, yeah. If you've already tuned out, then you wouldn't be listening to this, but anyway. I can't speak now, it's so late. Bye-bye. You can join us in the conversations in the many places like Discord, email, Twitter, Facebook, all those social media sites. All the links are in the show notes. Everything we talked about is in the show notes, and you can find the links there. So thank you guys for doing this podcast, and I'll leave you to go to bed now. Say bye.
Good night all.
Good night all.
Bye all. Right.
Call out the stop.
Three, two,
nice one.
One.